Case number 07-1151 et al. Natural Resources Defense Council petitioner versus Environmental Protection Agency. Mr. O'Brien for the petitioner, Mr. Levin for the respondent, Mr. Glacier for the intervener.
May it please the court, my name is Colin O'Brien. I am here with co-counsel John Walk. We are representing petitioners Natural Resources Defense Council. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Today's case is about maintaining the integrity of the National Ambient Air Quality Standards, or NAAQS, which govern pollutants such as lead, ozone, and particulate matter. The NAAQS, which are designed to protect public health above all other considerations, form the cornerstone of the Clean Air Act. States constantly monitor air to make sure that they are complying with the NAAQS. The issue today is when can data indicating violations of those health-based standards be disregarded? Although an exceptional occurrence, like a volcano, for example, may impact air quality data, prior to 2005, the Act did not provide any mechanism for adjusting such data. In 2005, however, Congress amended Section 319 of the Act, providing for waiver of data indicating violations under very narrow circumstances, and directed EPA to promulgate an implementing rule. EPA subsequently promulgated the exceptional events rule, which we challenge here. The Chevron Step 1 shortcomings of the rule can be summarized thusly. First, the rule's definition of natural event is unlawful because it encompasses a causal role for human activities and thereby evades a statutory limitation that is specific to human activities. Second, EPA relies on this definition of natural to rebrand certain anthropogenic pollution as natural. The key examples here are post-disaster cleanup, industrial pollution that is affected by wind, as well as industrial pollution that is transported. And this act of rebranding anthropogenic pollution as natural, again, evades the statutory limitation that is specific to human activities. The first point that I want to make is that the rule unlawfully defines natural event, as I said, to include a direct causal role for human activities. And here I want to draw the court's attention to the definition of exceptional event provided in the statute. Congress said very specifically that an exceptional event is a human activity that is unlikely to recur at a given location or a natural event. And the use of the disjunctive is important here because, as this court recently held in North Carolina versus EPA, the use of this disjunctive implies that the two terms need to be given separate meanings. And here, EPA has taken natural events and basically allowed it to, as I said, swallow human activities.
Well, let me ask you, one of the responses to your argument is that what the rule says is that in listing these examples, they will have to be tied to exceptional events. And you're assuming that, and indeed your brief at one point suggests that the agency has refused to do this.
Well, there are two problems with that. First, if you look to the text of the rule itself, it says that the following types of events will be deemed exceptional events. So there's nothing.
They may be deemed exceptional events.
Well, I think if
one exception that we'll talk about later, but most of it is we believe we may.
I believe the relevant text is at page 118 of the joint appendix, and The first sentence. Actually, there are two relevant sentences. In the first sentence, EPA says that the following categories meet the definition of exceptional event. And then they follow it up by saying, provided that they meet the other requirements of the Act.
Right.
The reason that that's important is that the key criteria from the statute, which means that the pollution may not be controllable or preventable, and that the pollution, if it's human, must be unlikely to recur, appears in the definition. So at the point where EPA says these events meet the definition, and then says, and may be excluded provided they meet the other criteria at that point necessarily refer to paperwork and procedural
now,
requirements.
On page 118, where are you reading?
I believe I got ahead of myself. If we go to page 117, yep. The first column at the bottom, examples of exceptional events.
Believes that the following types of events meet the definition. They may qualify.
At the point where they say that these events meet the definition, they've basically disposed of the criteria of controllability and preventability, and they've also foreclosed an inquiry into whether human activities are recurring. I would also, I think at this point it's also important to look at the text on page 129 of the Joint Appendix. And here EPA is discussing the high wind and the way that they treat high wind.
Okay, I agree with your argument that they're more definitive as to that, and I'm going to ask EPA to explain something to me, but you started out back on page 117 here, where we have this believe and may language. When we get to 129, EPA has identified in the preamble that this is part of the final rule, and that's where you have your high wind language that you're referencing, but I'm back on these other pages. I'm not clear why you say the court can ignore EPA's statements that these examples nevertheless have to comply with the statutory requirement of an exceptional event.
Typically, in EPA's brief, they say that at the point where a category has been identified as an exceptional event, you still need to look at the other criteria. But I invite you to look at the regulation itself. And here, if we're turning to page 133 of the Joint Appendix,
right,
you can see that the regulation is bifurcated into two sections. 50.1 presents the definition, and listed in the definition are the statute, it parrots the statute, and that's where the requirements of controllability or preventability and recurrence are lodged. Then, if you look at 50.14, that's where they list other requirements. I submit at the point where EPA says that we believe the following types of events meet the definition of exceptional event, they have committed to section 50.1 and that these categories that they've outlined are interpreted to meet the definition. So the reassurance that all of the other requirements, and here, don't forget that they're using the word other.
You're reading the examples in the preamble to be per se statements?
We take this language in the preamble to be binding, and here I would draw the court's attention.
What does that mean, though? I mean, they say that these are some of the categories. This is not an exclusive list. We're saying to the states, you can flag this, but nothing happens until EPA requires what its brief describes as rigorous criteria.
Well, the rigorous criteria that they're talking about, as I've explained, are procedural and paperwork.
No, but I understood the rigorous criteria, and tell me why I'm wrong on this, is that, one, it has to be an exceptional event, and then, two, it has to have this direct causation. Three, it can't be caused by a source that's otherwise not in compliance. I mean, it's those types of criteria.
I would agree with you that those are all criteria, but I would also point out that the definition is key here. At the point where EPA says the following types of events meet the definition, they've disposed of the criteria that are included in the statute, and at that point, their assurances of the other rigorous requirements basically hinge on paperwork and procedure. And again, I don't think that you can ignore the text on page 129 of the Joint Appendix, where EPA emphasizes that the preamble text itself constitutes the final rule. And I think here it's also...
Where does it say that?
If you look at Joint Appendix 129, Column 3.
Okay, those were the ones that we were talking about that I want to ask EPA about. But there, the final rule on 133 says there are these criteria. So the way I'm reading this preamble, and maybe I'm wrong about this, and EPA, and you should tell me, is that they're saying, here are the definitions we're going to apply, here are the criteria. And then on 129, they start listing some of these examples. And so if a state comes in and seeks a waiver for volcanic or seismic activities, for high wind events, for stratospheric ozone intrusion, and I don't know what this fireworks display is all about, but in any event, for those, then it'll go through this process, event by case by case.
I'm not sure that that's true because EPA has said that these categories meet the definition, and they've created a system where communities can flag data based on these categorical interpretations set forth in the rule. That's important. The second thing I would point out is that EPA's reassurances are absolutely hollow, that they're in enforcing the statutory criteria. When you look at the way that the rule discusses how different categories will be handled. Take, for example, high wind. Anthropogenic sources which were affected by high wind, EPA says, will be excluded as exceptional events if it originates out of state or if it originates in state and showings are made with respect to the controllability of that pollution.
Now, would you agree with me that the language as to high winds is not the same as the language for these other examples? In other words, EPA said as to high winds, we will do this.
Yes, I would agree. I would agree that it is more definite.
Well,
I don't
think... Before you start agreeing to that, there's a puzzle in this case that I hope maybe you or EPA can solve for me. If you turn on the high wind question, if you turn to the page that you were of the Federal Register 13576, and it's in the appendix of the brief at 23 and the joint appendix at 129, and that third column that you referred to?
Yes.
Right. It says on final rule, it says, the EPA's final rule concerning high wind events states that ambient, et cetera, et cetera. The final rule doesn't say any such thing.
That's my question to EPA.
Well,
yes.
And that's our argument, which is that EPA intends for the preamble and the regulation together to constitute the rule.
The better argument is that this is referring to a non-existent rule, that EPA never promulgated a rule stating, as Judge Rogers said, ambient particulate matter concentrations due to dust being raised by an unusually high will be treated due as uncontrollable natural events where, blah, blah, blah. There's no rule. You know, I think this is an error. And I think you've exposed it. I think it's an error in drafting. That my suspicion is that initially EPA, in fact, had a rule that said these things. But right now, it does not. And under the Supreme Court's decisions, and Morton versus Ruiz is one example, that they have to promulgate a rule. They can't do anything other than interpret their own rule that they have, and well, I don't know how they're going to interpret that. And I'll tell you, if you go back to A13 or 13566 and 13565 of the Federal Register, I think it's another example of EPA referring to what was a rule that never became a rule. It says, several commentators suggest that EPA replaced the term high winds with the term wind-generated dust because, et cetera, et cetera. Replace it where in the rule? But there is no rule that says that.
Well,
can you explain all this to me? I mean, they're referring to a rule that doesn't exist.
Your Honor, I cannot explain, and I think that those questions are best reserved for EPA, but that is why petitioners...
And it's a violation, by the way, for EPA to enforce this, quote, you know, the rules stating, et cetera, would be a violation of Section 552A1D of the, actually it's the Freedom of Information Act, but it's part of the APA. Because any rule that EPA wants to enforce has to be published in the Federal Register, and whatever rule they're talking about here was never published.
Well, I don't disagree that there are substantial problems with this rule, but the reason that we're bringing this challenge and that it's important for the court to rule on the extent to which EPA may rely on this preamble is precisely the scenario that is taking shape in the Ninth Circuit. We're bringing a facial challenge saying these categories of exceptional events violate the law on its face, and EPA is telling us that we can't bring the challenge, that it's not ripe, and that we need to defer to an applied challenge. In the Ninth Circuit, different petitioners have attacked both the way that the rule has been applied, invoking high winds in the San Joaquin Valley, but they've also brought a facial attack. And there, EPA has said that any facial attack is foreclosed by the review provision of the Clean Air Act. And they cite to our litigation as being the only opportunity for a facial challenge. And then they go on to say, citing only the preamble, if you look to the EPA merits brief that we submitted to you, if you look at pages 31 through 33, what they cite as their quote-unquote controlling interpretation that is to be afforded substantial deference is the preamble text itself. And it cannot be that EPA can set forth all of these categories that meet the definition of exceptional event and then have them insulated from review here as well as on an applied challenge.
An example of what you object to in terms of a natural event that has a little human cause.
Well, I think the prime example from the preamble is that they would excuse the human activities that occur after a natural disaster to clean it up. They would allow industrial emissions, things like carbon monoxide and sulfur dioxide, which are associated with heavy diesel-operated equipment. They would allow those emissions to continue daily and perhaps daily up to a year, if not longer, and they would excuse those under the rubric of natural. We would submit that
Or is it a human activity unlikely to recur at a particular location? Why isn't that a human activity unlikely to occur if at a particular location? It's a cleanup.
Because those activities, the actual activities that give rise to the exceedance of the standard are the operation of that equipment.
That's a cleanup. The hypothetical you gave me is a cleanup. So
right.
It's unlikely, you know, once you clean it up, it's unlikely to recur at that particular location. Why isn't it? So therefore it's excluded. Give me another example of an activity that you object to that has human activity plays a little role in.
Well, I think high winds are another example.
If somebody's driving in a national forest and flicks their cigarette out, is that and causes a forest fire, is that a natural event or is that an activity that has a human causal event?
We have not challenged the treatment of fire, but...
Why? I mean, there's a human element in that, isn't there?
Well, I think it's important to refer...
Is there a human element in the causation of a forest fire?
Yes.
Yeah. And it could be caused by lightning. It could be caused by the guy flicking the cigarette out, right?
Right.
So if that's okay to treat that as a natural event, why is... You know, what are these other things? I don't even know what they are. They're purely abstract to me.
I would point you to the statutory language where Congress used the disjunctive and said that an event must be natural or it must be classified as a human activity. I would also refer you to the legislative history where Congress indicated that natural events are those that create pollution as a consequence of natural ecological processes. And things like post-disaster cleanup is not related at all to a natural ecological process. Additionally, it's important to look at the justification that EPA gives for their definition. They say that small, historic human influences shouldn't preclude an otherwise natural event from being deemed natural. And it can't be the case that ongoing human cleanup activities that cause daily exceedances of the NAAQS can be excused as small or historic.
Was the flooding in New Orleans a natural event? Or was that a human-caused event?
I would submit that that's a natural event. Or
even though the flooding would not have occurred but for the fact that houses destroyed, the dikes that were put up.
I agree that there is in that instance both potentially a human and a natural component. We think that if that's the case and there's a hybrid situation, EPA must confront both of them or each of the multiple causes under the prong of the statute that would govern them independently. Additionally, it's not petitioner's obligation to defend every example that might be problematic or instances where the rule could be applied legally.
Yes, it is. Now, wait a minute. Yeah. Now, this is a very important point. It's not your burden to show that the rule would be invalid in all its applications. That's what you're saying.
In all factual circumstances.
Okay. Now, stop there. The Supreme Court held in Reno versus Flores, in an opinion by Justice Scalia, that if you attack a regulation on its face, in order to have it struck down, your obligation is to show that the regulation would be invalid in all of its applications, as a direct holding of the Supreme Court. So if you are now taking the position that we can't do that, you lose.
To distinguish the case that you cited from the situation that's presented here, when you look, for example,
are you familiar with Reno versus Flores?
Yes, but the thing I want to point out is take high winds, for example. The statute says that if pollution is anthropogenic, it's subject to two criteria. First, it must be not controllable or preventable, and it must be not likely to recur. If you look at EPA's rule, it does not, when the anthropogenic pollution originates out of state, even make any inquiry into whether or not that pollution is controllable or preventable. Similarly, because EPA did this evasive 1-2 step and classifies all wind as natural, they make no inquiry into whether or not the pollution is likely to recur. So the point here is that the rule that EPA has committed to doesn't even make the statutorily required inquiry to the extent that EPA is classifying and making decisions about what is exceptional and not. And that's the distinction between the case that you cited, Your Honor, Judge Randolph, which is at the point where EPA sets forth the process for determining what is exceptional and what is not, they ignore flatly the requirements of the statute.
Is the unlikely to recur, does that apply only to human activity, or is that at a particular location, or does that also apply to a natural event?
That prong is exclusive to human activities, and that's why, and that's the flaw of EPA's natural events definition.
Well, that doesn't, let me interrupt you, pardon. But why isn't it, if you're in a canyon and the prevailing winds are 40 miles an hour ripping down that canyon, and the mining activity is going on, throwing up all kinds of zinc and lead and all that, and it's high wind by anybody's estimation, 40 miles an hour, but it's constantly occurring, why should that be treated as exempt? If it's
exempt from the rule or exempt from application of the NAAQS?
Exempt from application of the NAAQS.
Well, the backdrop of the statute
is a natural event, but it's not one that's unlikely to recur. It occurs all the time. That's the prevailing wind in the valley.
Well, The statute requires that where the emissions are anthropogenic, it is subject to this additional test, which is it likely to recur? And the problem with the example that you gave is that EPA automatically assumes that the pollution is natural, and it never makes an inquiry into whether or not it's likely to recur in violation of the statute. I would also add that if your example somehow involved the trans-border transport of that pollution, they don't in that situation even inquire into whether or not the pollution was controllable or preventable, which is a condition for all exceptional events, even those that are natural.
Right. Okay. Got it. Thanks.
I believe that I'm over time.
We'll give you some time to reply. Mr. Levin?
May it please the Court, I'm Joshua Levin with the United States Department of Justice on behalf of EPA. With me is Padmini Singh of EPA OGC. Before I begin, I'd like to reserve or cede 3 minutes of my time for counsel for interveners. Your Honors, contrary to NRDC's claims this morning, the rule treats exceptional events as the exception, and it demands strict proof that an emissions exceedance was caused by the event in question. I want to focus on three main points this morning in addition to addressing the Court's own questions.
Well, could you just tell us about this rule that we've been, both Judge Randolph and I, have questioned about? The rule starts on JA 133, and it has 50.1 and 50.14, and that's it.
Yes, Your Honor,
that's what EPA tells us that they are doing when they're amending Part 50. Yet, previously, in a number of places, like, for example, JA 129, in the second column, middle column, it talks about this final rule. And it does that again on JA 130. But there's nothing in the final rule in Part 50 that deals with all of this. So what do we have here?
Well, Your Honor, what I think we have here is a regulation which meets the statutory requirements by spelling out what EPA's definition of exceptional event is, and moreover, its definition critically of natural event. Through the genesis of the rule, the commenters, in my recollection, did not argue, as the Court now seems interested in knowing, that the preamble contents should and must only be in the rule. And EPA, in its discretion, decided that, in fact, it was important and appropriate for the preamble to be the place where guidance could be provided to states.
Yeah, I'm not getting at that. I'm getting at that in the preamble, it identifies parts of the preamble as the final rule, and yet the final rule doesn't have those provisions in them.
Your Honor, I'll concede that that's at least an inartful use of the word will.
So how do we read this rule? That's what I need to know.
Well, with regard to high winds, I'll note that that is also identified in the earlier portions where EPA used the terms may constitute and EPA believes.
Do you have the joint appendix in front of you?
I do.
JA 129. So EPA says in Part 7, this final rule, and then it lists A, B, C, going over to page 130. So are we to read all of that as part of the promulgated final rule?
Your Honor, EPA, with regard to each of these events, would ask the Court to treat these events as it would any other events covered earlier in the preamble. Despite their placement in a separate section, EPA is going to be making...
I don't think that works, counsel. I mean, Judge Rogers is absolutely right. That you've got EPA is finalizing its proposal with regards to volcanic and seismic activities and gives all this detail. And then it says EPA's final rule concerning high wind events states that ambient. It doesn't state any such thing. And the next page on you know, the whatever, the third column, EPA is finalizing the approach stated in the proposed rule to treat emissions from fireworks similar to exceptional offense. Where are the final rules that say any such thing? It doesn't. This is referring to a non-existent rule. The preamble, what is, under the APA, what does a preamble do?
The preamble provides the agency's contemporaneous interpretation of its promulgated rule.
It's supposed to be a short, plain statement of the reasons for the rule. That's what a preamble is under the APA. And under the Federal Register Act, if you have a rule, you've got to publish it. This is referring to a non-existent rule, a rule that was never published. It's not interpreting anything. It's referring to our rule says this. It doesn't say any such thing. I don't see how we could possibly uphold this on the basis that when it refers to something that doesn't exist. It looks to me like a total drafting error. Was there, in the notice of proposed rulemaking, were there details regarding high winds and fireworks and volcanoes and all that stuff?
Yes, Your Honor. The preamble, in many respects, is...
No, not the preamble. I'm talking about in the proposed rule.
Oh, I see. I'll have an opportunity to check that during... further portions of the argument, but I believe that for the most part the proposed rule resembled closely the rule we have in front of us. And one of the reasons is I think that largely the affected community understood that EPA was going to be applying its definitions in a broad set of circumstances, and as it made clear throughout, is going to ask each state to provide data to demonstrate the causal relationship between the putative exceptional event and the exceedance. That's made very clear in the rule itself. That's spelled out on Joint Appendix page 134. The criteria that are noted there in the middle column under Romanet 3 are criteria which apply to every demonstration by a state, regardless of whether it's high winds, fireworks, cleanups after natural disasters. And that's the whole point, that EPA understood that the rule needed to spell out what its definition of natural event was and needed to spell out what an exceptional event was and how to give states a set of guidelines for making the showing. But other than that, it understood from the outset, and I think EPA would concede that the word will is problematic, but from the outset it understood that every situation would present new sets of facts which are reviewable in regional courts of appeals, as petitioners mentioned.
There was a 1986 guidance document that dealt with, for example, high winds, right?
There are several guidance documents, and one of the key points I want to make with regard to the definition of natural events is that the guidance documents EPA historically used, including ones that used the concept of anthropogenic events being part of high winds, were specifically noted and endorsed by Congress in section 319B. In that section, as we've noted, Congress mandated that those pre-existing guidance documents would continue until EPA's regulations were finalized. And that's a pivotal point here in terms of whether EPA's current definition of natural events, which we think...
The guidance documents deal with fireworks, for example, or volcanoes, or they dealt with high winds, I know that.
They certainly dealt with the volcanoes example, Your Honor. I believe it's volcanoes and earthquakes that are considered in the early days, and all EPA has done with regard to that kind of cleanup is understand that there's no reason to cabin off those kind of natural events from others.
So maybe the writer of this Federal Register, the preamble or whatever, when it says the EPA's final rule concerning high wind events states that ambient particulate, et cetera, blah, 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 is not referring to the rule at all. Maybe it's referring to the guidance document. Did the guidance document deal with that ambient particulate matter concentrations due to dust being raised by unusually high winds treated as uncontrollable where the dust originated from, blah, blah, blah. You know, is that the way the guidance document reads?
The relevant guidance document is the PM10 natural events policy, which is at Joint Appendix 397. And I can turn to it. I'm confident that the court will find a lot of similarity in the way that that guidance document treated high winds and the role that anthropogenic events can play.
See, that's what I thought you might have suggested in response to my question about the three, the ABC on JA 129 to 30.
Yes, if I can
ask. That's what EPA had always been doing under this previous guidance.
Well, in fact, at Joint Appendix 403, it's clear that EPA used a concept of anthropogenic sources being a component within high winds as long ago as the date of that guidance document, which is 1996.
We're two trains passing in the night here. You're talking about your definition of natural events, and I'm still back trying to identify what is the rule we have here.
Yeah. Your Honor, I don't know that I can shed light on whether this particular guidance document was contained.
So in preparing for this case, you took it to be that the final rule consists of what appears on the joint appendix at 133 only, and the rest of this, prior to that, statement of the amendments to Part 50 is all preamble language in the nature of guidance to states as to what types of events they could flag and then present to EPA for possible waiver?
That is right, Your Honor. Now, having said that, we do note that the court is always allowed to look at a preamble in attempting to better understand the reasonableness of the rule itself. And we'd even recognize that NRDC would have had a chance to ask for court review regarding any purely legal issues that are contained in the guidance document.
All right. Well, take
in the preamble, but we didn't think that their petition did that precisely.
All right.
With regard to high winds, we focus on the fact that it's listed in the earlier portions, where it's identified as a potential category subject to EPA review in any one case, and EPA certainly never has intended to set in stone the fact that any putative event associated with high winds will be deemed exceptional event.
Well, you're asking the court to say then that was a mistake in using the word will in describing the high wind events, and that when the preamble says that EPA will consider such events as eligible for waiver, even without reference to these other statutory requirements, that we should ignore that?
Your Honor, I would ask you to, in the context of high winds, I would ask you to focus on the fact that it's identified elsewhere as a likely category, as a category that EPA expects it will see a lot of action with. In fact, as NRDC noted, there is currently a case in the Ninth Circuit which involves it. In that case, I believe the question is not before the court whether high winds can ever be a category, but the question is simply whether EPA reasonably reviewed and agreed with the conclusions reached by the state that an exclusion was warranted.
That's an as-applied, if I can put it that way. But here, the petitioners are arguing that as to high winds, the statement in the preamble, at least as to out of order events, is just contrary to the requirements of the statute. So that's a legal argument.
Well, Your Honor,
and following up on Judge Randolph's point, I mean, they're saying that there can be no application of this statement that is consistent with the statute.
It's certainly not EPA's intent that the court assume that the high winds will invariably and without changing its mind treat high winds as a category. To the extent that the word will conveys that, we would acknowledge that there's somewhat of a drafting error there.
I want to come back I want to be clear about what your explanation is when EPA says the final rule concerning high winds states. What is that supposed to mean? What is that referring to when we can't find a final rule that states any such thing? What do we do with that?
Your Honor, I certainly read that before the argument, and my impression was, and perhaps it was a wrong impression, my impression was that EPA, both with regard to high winds and the other examples that are described in equal detail, expects this to be a set of rules of the road for the most commonly encountered kinds of events. Now, the word will may convey another legal meaning to the court, but I believe...
I'm not worried about will. I'm saying what I'm concerned about is that EPA is saying its final rule states as follows, and it doesn't.
Yeah, well, all I can say is that you're right. The facts don't match up. There isn't a corresponding reference in the rule. And
there's a lot of case law saying we're supposed to be, in fact, the jurisdiction of our court is limited to reviewing final rules. And true enough, a preamble, it gives us a basis for interpreting a rule. But when we have EPA referring to a rule that doesn't exist, what are we reviewing?
Well, Your Honor, we certainly believe that the court can affirm the rule itself and can look at certainly the vast majority of aspects that are described here without having anything to do with whether the court is troubled by the separate treatment that's given to high wind events. We nonetheless...
There's not any high winds. It's volcanic action and fireworks and, you know, all the rest.
See, and in the final rule itself, it includes fireworks displays. I mean, it sort of singles that one out as opposed to all the others.
Your Honor, as the court knows, that's not been something challenged by petitioners. And
no, but it's trying to understand the challenge in light of what is the rule we're reviewing.
Yeah. We're asking the court to review the rule on its face. The rule is the document which will be part of the code. We're asking the court not to review the preambular examples for any of them because we believe that the court should properly await a more concrete context, either in this court in the appropriate setting
and
or down the road.
Approach, we have to rewrite the preamble, at least as to high winds, as saying may instead of will.
Well, Your Honor,
but you said that was an unfortunate choice of words.
It's an unfortunate choice of words, and I think the court, you know, could acknowledge that EPA does not intend to treat high winds in any manner differently than the other aspects for which that more absolute phrasing is used. So we don't believe that a rewriting the preamble is warranted. We believe that the court can and should affirm the rule itself and appreciate that the other challenges are simply improper at this juncture. If the court has no more questions, I will give several minutes to counsel for the interveners.
All right. Mr.
Thank you. The argument I'd like to address is the contention that petitioner raises here that mining and agricultural emissions and indeed emissions from any recurring human activity, including, for instance, construction projects, can never be excluded under Section 319B, even if the emissions would not have caused a NAAQS exceedance absent a qualifying exceptional events such as, and in particular, a high wind event.
And I really took the point in your brief in my first question to petitioner that since the agency has said in this preamble that the what I'll call the root cause has to be an exceptional event, that its argument that somehow the rule can be read without reference to that is just incorrect.
And we would completely agree with that. And in fact, I think part of the problem here is that petitioners keep saying that, for instance, mining and agricultural emissions can never be excluded because those emissions themselves are not natural events. But the natural event here, and this is what the statute says, what has to be natural is the event. So the natural event here is the high wind event. In addition, the statute explicitly holds open the possibility that natural events, such as high wind events, acting on anthropogenic emissions could be excluded, because the statute specifically says that sources, uncontrolled sources or air pollution related from to source non-compliance, that can't be excluded under the natural events rule, leading to the reasonable conclusion that if the source is controlled, that Congress would have anticipated that that could be excluded. I'd also like to focus briefly on the waiver issue, because we presented a fairly substantial argument in our brief that NRDC did not, in its rulemaking comments, raise the issue that it's raising here today, that anthropogenic emissions, even if there's a high wind event, can never be excluded. That argument was not responded to at all in the reply brief.
Well, the problem there is that in the proposed rule, as I understand it, EPA didn't list agriculture and mining. There were some comments about agriculture and mining. And then in the final rule, EPA talks about agriculture and mining. So the petitioners say, how could they have known? Because EPA never gave them notice.
Right.
But EPA simply says, well, we said the list wasn't exclusive. And then it points to another rulemaking which should have given the petitioners notice, which is an interesting argument.
Right, but that whole argument where EPA raised agriculture and mining, that's in the context of transported air pollution. Mm-hmm. That's a very narrow situation. What I'm addressing here is where we don't have transport. The transport that EPA was addressing there is long-range transport. The examples they give in that preamble are things like Asian or African dust or forest fires in Mexico. I'm not talking about that, because these types of emissions that we're talking about from the mining and agricultural industry, they're relatively heavy crustal materials, and they don't transport very far. Our concern is simply dust blowing off a mine property in an unusually high wind event, or dust blowing off an agricultural field that doesn't transport very far but does hit a monitor.
You're supporting the portion of the natural event definition that says little? Is that your argument?
That says little?
Little, yes. Human activity plays little or no.
No. We're saying that we have a when you have, the statute says that the event, what has to be natural is the event. The event is the high wind. The high wind is purely natural. High wind is not something that mining or agriculture or other anthropogenic activity plays any role in. At the same time, we understand that the statute says that
the high wind doesn't cause pollution.
Well, the high wind, but the statute doesn't say causes pollution. Statute, the definition that we're talking about, what has to be the natural event, or what has to be the exceptional event, is the natural event, and the natural event is the high wind. Now, we agree that but for the high wind event causing a NAAQS violation, you don't get an exclusion. So there has to be a direct causal relationship between the purely natural event, the high wind, and the NAAQS violation. So we understand that, but Congress dealt with that, saying that if there's source noncompliance, then you're not excused, and
so
we understand that.
The human activity plays little role. You don't need that in your...
No, absolutely not, and that is why we say that petitioners did not raise this argument in their comments. The only thing that we can see in their comments where they raised anything remotely like this is where they said it was the cleanup activities after a natural disaster, and that whole argument was, is there some human activity? Is it mixed human and natural, and how would that work? That's got nothing to do with the type of argument that we're raising here. Now, just in closing, I do think that we need to focus on the rule language itself and not the preambular language, and so whichever direction the court decides to go on here, what we're requesting here is that we not get a ruling that EPA, the regulation itself, somehow violated 319B because it contemplates or allows exclusions of data where there is a high wind event acting on a controlled anthropogenic source. Thank you very much.
All right, does Mr. O'Brien have any time? All right, why don't you take 2 minutes?
Thank you, Your Honor. The first point that I want to make is that NRDC would be satisfied with a ruling holding that only the rule text is the rule, and further that the preambular text and the examples included therein have no legal significance or authorizing force or legal permission for EPA or the states. And the reason that that ruling is important is that, as we pointed out in our 28J letter, in the Ninth Circuit, EPA, although in this forum has completely disavowed the applicability or the importance of the preamble, cites the preamble language exclusively as its controlling interpretation. And that's why it's...
What about treating the preamble as simply guidance to the states for purposes of flagging?
Well, I think still then, Your Honors would have to wade into the formulation of some of the examples, because take high wind, for example.
EPA isn't bound by it. There's a legal effect. How can we get to it?
I would submit that this court should not allow EPA to provide guidance that is on its face contradictory to the statute.
Okay. Let me ask you, the final rule. Excuse me?
The only issue...
If the guidance is, our rule states as follows, A, B, C, D, and you look at the rule, it doesn't state any such thing. And...
Well, we believe that the rule is premised on examples that violate the statute. The actual regulation itself, we only have one problem with, and that's the definition of natural event. So if this court were to say that the preamble is not the rule.
The fact that, will you please give me an example of something that would fall within the literal role, that human activity has literal role?
Well, I think the one example that was talked about in the preamble to the proposal is that forest fires and their intensity, or even just their occurrence, may be the product of lightning in part, but also the fact that humans have made management decisions about when to reduce fuel load, when to cultivate the forest. And so there, the small human impact on that landscape from forest management decisions perhaps should not disqualify a lightning strike from...
I thought you agreed with that problem.
We did not challenge the treatment of fire in the rule.
An example that you an activity, a human activity that plays a literal role in a natural event that you disagree with EPA.
EPA uses the definition of natural to treat high winds in every instance as natural, and also to create industrial post cleanup activities as natural. Neither of those comport with the definition of natural, and similarly, those are not small, those are not little, those are not historic, those are exclusive.
Excuse me, Mr. Brown. Does EPA treat post, cleanup activities as natural events, or does it treat it as a human activity at a particular location and likely to recur?
It treats it exclusively as natural.
Where do I find that?
If you look at, let's see, if you look at page 118 of the joint appendix.
Oh, I got to pull that. What's the Federal Register saying?
It's 13565, the bottom of column 1. The natural events addressed by this final rule are, 1, natural disasters and associated cleanup activities.
Where does it say that?
If you go to the very bottom of the page under number 5, natural events.
5. You're on JA 118?
Yes, the bottom of the first column.
Thank you.
And petitioners underscore that that's why independent of how you decide to treat our attacks on the categories of exceptional event that are set forth in the preamble, it is still critical that this court invalidate EPA's definition of natural events, because it violates the, Chevron Step 1. It's not consistent with the disjunctive construction. It doesn't comport with the literal meaning of the words natural. It also ignores legislative history, which indicates that natural events are associated with natural ecological processes. And also, although EPA submits that Congress intended it to adopt the guidelines that the agency has promulgated previously, a plain meaning or a plain reading of the statute shows that Congress intended those guidelines. It referred to them very specifically to apply on an interim basis only.
How do we know that? It talks about hurricanes and tornadoes and the cleanup activity associated with them. How do we know whether it, well, if we don't call it a natural event, we call it a human activity in a particular location unlikely to recur?
At the point where heavy machinery is operated day in and day out on consecutive days for up to and potentially extending beyond a year, those discrete violations of the health standard.
Tornado in Kansas, it just so happens to go over an area where toxic waste is stored in a secure, what thought to be a secure facility, and the tornado lifts it up and spews it all out. Right? People clean it up. Is that a, if that's not a natural event with little human input, then why isn't it a human act, the cleanup, the human activity at a particular location unlikely to recur?
As EPA notes in its brief on page 51, the critical legal inquiry is to the source of the emissions. The cleanup is the emissions from the cleanup are not a product of the hurricane. At that point, the emissions are being caused.
I'm assuming that. That's not my question. Why isn't, if it doesn't fall within that, why doesn't it fall within the human activity at a particular location unlikely to recur?
Because it's controllable or preventable.
My hypothetical was that they did everything that was required. It's just that we had this huge tornado that nobody anticipated.
In that situation, the operation of the diesel equipment and the construction and reconstruction activities are controllable, preventable, and those types of activities would, under any other circumstance, be controllable or preventable and would be required to comply with the NAAQS. I mean, remember that the NAAQS is a health-based standard. The purpose of the Clean Air Act is to protect public health, and indeed, the number one principle articulated in Section 319 is that the exceptional events rule should not be construed in a way that sacrifices is public health.
All right. Can I just ask one quick question? The final rule on JA-133 refers to fireworks specifically. Do we take your argument to reach fireworks?
Your Honor, which argument is that specifically?
Well, you don't specifically mention fireworks, so that's what I'm trying to understand here. Whether your argument challenging the final rule does not argue that fireworks are an impermissible exceptional event.
Correct. We do not argue that. So if the court were to reach it, it would be sua sponte.
Presumably. You don't argue it, but is that a consequence of your argument? I can see the headline tomorrow. NRDC wants to ban fireworks on July 4th. I mean, I don't know how that would affect your fundraising.
Right. I would submit that in trying to discern whether the definition of natural event is legal or not, you need not focus on fireworks, but on the Chevron Step 1 analysis that we've presented here and in our brief. Namely, that definition does not comport with the statute.
All right. Thank you. We'll take a short break.
Thank you.